Hello, I'm Christina Marie Jeffers. This is number 0880, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0880. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Alan R. Warren, who is a best-selling true crime author. His latest book is called Cults, The Interviews, Volume 9. Why is it that people get into cults in the first place?
It's usually about life and about death and about how we're going to survive the death, or like what's going to happen to us. And a lot of people fight with that fear throughout their life. And this is kind of an alternative to a mainstream or standard religion that for some reason they didn't take to or they don't believe in. It could be any of the leaders of a cult, David Koresh or any of them. And they get connected with those people and they begin to follow that. And that fills that big void that they feel that they have about life and death.
Kira Hartley Klinger is an entrepreneur, internet seller, and the author of two books, Fabric Wars and Fabric Wars and More. You'd be surprised at some of what her bestsellers are.
We're talking slips and we're talking the women's old underwear and things like that. Women's underwear, like the old silky ones that go up to the rib cage, those the granny panties. They're worth money. I don't know why. It's odd. But I pulled out a handful of better than average used granny panties and I made like $300 on stuff that I paid nothing for.
Mark Hartzman, the curator of WeirdHistorian.com, is back with the weird story for June. This one deals with a two-headed man.
I knew of Pascal Pignon from my own sideshow researching, but I didn't know the full story of how he lost his second head. And I came across a newspaper headline, which is, I think, maybe the best newspaper headline I've found. This one reads, Two-Headed Man Loses One Head, which is really a brilliant headline. So after that, that kind of put an end to his career on stage. No one wanted to go see the one-headed man or the man who used to have two heads. He had to retire at that point. He was in his 60s by then. At least he survived, even though his career did not. But he returned home to Mexico and went into retirement there.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, dad joke theater, Sir Dudley's Poetry Corner, a morning shower thought, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guests later. The person who told you this was show number 0880 was Christina Marie Jeffers, the executive director for Access Humboldt, which includes a station that the Stuff File program is heard weekly on. It's Eureka, California, KZZHLPFM.
Kazam!
Thank you very much, Christina, for doing the guests late on this edition of the Stuff File program. A show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. An Oklahoma Arby's employee faces felony charges for allegedly spitting in a customer's food, with the victim claiming she contracted oral herpes from the incident. 38-year-old Amanda Hendricks was charged with poisoning food with intent to injure after surveillance footage showed her spitting into sandwiches at the Broken Bow restaurant in March. Customer Jenica Church, also 38, ordered a meal through the drive-thru and later developed painful lesions and cold sores, testing positive for herpes simplex virus type 1. Church filed a lawsuit alleging Hendricks worked despite having an active herpes outbreak with visible lesions. When questioned by police, Hendricks reportedly admitted to the act, saying, "Yes, she did it." Church now fears transmitting the virus to her husband and children. Okay, I'm confused. The lawsuit alleges that Hendricks worked despite having an active herpes outbreak with visible lesions. Shouldn't the main point be that she purposely spit into food that she was preparing?
Arby's, we have the
herpes simplex!
A visitor at Camp Edison in California's Sierra Nevada foothills required emergency rescue June 21st after falling into a vault toilet while attempting to retrieve dropped sunglasses. The Fresno County Sheriff's Office reported the man tumbled into the chemical storage tank at a popular campground. Emergency crews conducted a confined space rescue operation, successfully extracting the victim within approximately 15 minutes. Cal Fire personnel hosed down the man after his removal from the toilet facility. Officials confirmed he sustained no injuries from the incident. The sheriff's office did not specify whether the visitor successfully recovered his sunglasses. You know, generally speaking, anything I drop into a toilet, I consider lost forever. Hong Kong will debut its first round-the-clock convenience store operated entirely by an artificial intelligence robot. The Hong Kong waterfront location features Xiao Gai, a humanoid robot manufactured by Galbot, measuring approximately 5 feet 6 inches tall, with an over 6-foot arm span and a 7.8-foot reach capability. The G1 model performs shelf stocking, product selection, and customer checkout operations while managing inventory automatically. Galbot describes the robot as having visual and auditory perception, enabling intent understanding, voice interaction, and target recognition for real-world decision-making. Galbot projects the novelty factor could increase foot traffic by 40% and plans expanding to 10 major international cities. Well, increased traffic makes increased profits, especially when you consider that they no longer have to pay those, and I'm doing air quotes, pesky humans. Also, they're going international. Could you imagine if they had one of these in, say, a New York City bodega? In a split second, like a Formula One pit crew, Xiao Gai would be up on blocks and sold for spare parts. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And speaking of spare parts, Hungarian authorities arrested a 30-year-old hospital orderly in Budapest on June 17th after discovering he had been storing human body parts at his home and workplace. The National Bureau of Investigation seized skulls, a complete lower leg, a hand, facial skin reconstructed into a human face, and bones stored in a suitcase. A heart preserved in a jar was also recovered, pending testing to confirm its origin. During questioning, the man admitted collecting the remains from abandoned cemeteries in Slovakia and Hungary and through his hospital job. He also confessed to preparing and eating human body parts. Police described him as having a passion for anatomy and animal dissection. He faces charges of illegal use of human bodies, with additional charges possible, pending forensic examination. Yikes! Remember Jeffrey Dahmer? Actually, remember the miniseries on TV about Jeffrey Dahmer?
It's a sandwich.
Thank you. I'll eat it later.
Eat it now.
Yeah, I'll pass. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Alan R. Warren is a best-selling true crime author with 38 books under his belt. He's also the producer and lead host of the internationally syndicated radio show and podcast called House of Mystery. His latest book is called Cults, The Interviews, Volume 9. Alan joins us from Seattle, Washington via Riverside.com. Hi, Alan.
Hey, how you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. The book from the House of Mystery radio show presents Cults, The Interviews, Volume 9. How did this come to be? I mean, I would assume that there are eight previous volumes.
Yeah. And I started putting them together with some of the co-hosts, and it was mainly to kind of highlight some of the special interviews we did with people. There was the Charles Manson. We interviewed a lot of the family, so that was one of them. A lot of JFK assassination people that were involved. So they were just, they each one had a theme, and that's what it was. And this one now is cults.
What is the fascination for you with cults?
I think there's a couple of things. One is more about how people get into them and how they become, where they worship them. Everything they live for is the cult or the cult leader. And also who they were and how it changed them.
Do you talk to anyone who is out of a cult?
Yeah, actually, this book, each one of these interviews are people that had been in one of the major cults, lived through it, and now they're out, or mostly they're all out. There's a few that are still in the cult, but each one of them had been through the main parts. So like when we talked to people of Jonestown, there was a lady who was just a little girl at the time. She escaped during the Kool-Aid event and survived, and she's not in the cult now, so we talked to her about her experience being in that. So that's one sample.
When you talk to people who were outside of the cult, who had left the cult, did any of them give any kind of a positive spin as to why they were in the cult, or did they just regret the whole circumstance now that they're out?
Well, I think most of them regret it and are not happy about their choice. Some of them, like Leslie Wilson, who I talked to out of Jonestown, was only a young little girl. So it's not like she really had a choice. It was more of her mother's decision to put her in and join the cult. So that's kind of a different situation. The ones that are supportive or try to spin it in a good way are ones that remained in the cult, even if the cult is gone now, and they still believe in what they were doing.
Do you worry or concern yourself? I mean, you speak about cults on your show, you speak about cults in the books. Do you ever worry about somebody coming after you because you are, for lack of a better term, exposing cults?
You always have that in the back of your mind, but I think for the most part, I'm not too worried. I think that I give a pretty fair and open talk. Like I don't sit there and interview these people and then treat them badly or talk to them like they're stupid or things like that. It's not about that. It's about getting to know a person, what kind of life they were living, and why they joined the cult, and how it worked for them. What was the good parts, the bad parts, or were there any? So it's not, I'm not as worried about that. And only that, well, I just have your address as my address, so everybody will come see you thinking you're me.
Is there a common denominator as far as people who get into cults? Of course, besides those who were taken in as children, why are people gravitating toward cults?
Well, it's usually about life and about death and about how we're going to survive the death. Like, what's going to happen to us? What are we going to lose? Are we losing everything when we die? Is there nothing? And a lot of people fight with that fear throughout their life. And this is kind of an alternative to a mainstream or standard religion that for some reason they didn't take to, or they don't believe in, or they don't follow. This is a closer, upfront, you know, usually you have someone like, it could be any of the leaders of a cult, David Koresh or any of them, and they get connected with those people and they begin to follow that. And that fills that big void that they feel that they have about life and death.
Is there any particular cult that scares you the most, either past or present?
I don't think one scares me any more than the other. I think maybe some of the bigger ones that tend to, you know, become almost mainstream, you know, popular, and you start to have too many people following it, and they seem to lose their independence. They seem to lose their way of, you know, thinking for things for themselves, and that's kind of that would be the scariest ones. But again, I don't think one's any worse than the other, because within the cult themselves, they have a beginning, middle, and end, and the leaders are usually looking to gain something from that cult for themselves. So it's not necessarily a threat to me personally.
In your estimation, what exactly is a cult as opposed to what I like to think of as cultish tendencies?
Well, they're very close to the same. I think the in the old-fashioned setup, so when a lot of these ones I had written about happened years ago, before the internet, before social media, and the easier connection. So they were a little bit more distinct in the way that people would have to go, like you have to go to Waco, Texas to join Koresh and become part of that cult. You have to be there. Nowadays, it's easier to join groups and be parts of them online, to have like a website or have social media groups that are just dedicated to a theory or a cult. And so it becomes easier, and it's less to, I don't know, it's not as direct. So you could have a cult right now, and you could have members all over the world, all over the country, in specific areas. You could have meetings. You could go online and Zoom, or you could even FaceTime people. You know, it's not the same. It's not the same game, as you say, anymore.
Well, do you think that people toss around the cult moniker a little too much?
Yes and no. I think that it's become, you know, someone says cult, and it's generally a negative thought. And yeah, people throw that on anything nowadays, just like they do with a lot of words, right? There's a lot of that stuff going on in all sorts of fields, not just cults, you know, politics, everything. You know, people just label things all the time. It makes it easier. I think in any group, that if they take away your freedom, your ability to make your own choices and decisions, that becomes cult, more, not just tendencies, but it becomes a cult, because then you're directed how to live. And, you know, so what's the fine line there? If are they directing you, saying, well, you shouldn't drink alcohol, and you don't? Or is it even deeper than that, you know, where you have to go live with them, or you can only do certain behaviors to stay into the cult, or they, if you talk to that person, we'll kick you out. You know, there's a lot of other things that they start wangling in, like making it so that people have less choice. And that's where it goes down that rabbit hole of becoming a cult.
I mentioned in the introduction that you are the lead host of the internationally syndicated radio show and podcast called House of Mystery. In the remaining moments that we have here on the program, tell us about House of Mystery and how people can find it.
Well, House of Mystery, it started 16 years ago. And what we do is we do interviews with things that are mysterious, and it could be anything from a cult or a murder case to right through to the JFK assassination to ghosts and paranormal. So it's a mystery based. We also talked to a lot of mystery writers about what they do and how they write. It's found on most platforms. It's syndicated through NBC, so it's on their stations in the West Coast, Seattle and LA. And the day after it airs, it goes up on podcast, and there's YouTube and everything. If you go to alanrwarren.com, or if you go to houseofmysteryradio.com, it's a connected website. It gives you all the platforms, a link to all the shows and interviews. So that's probably the best way.
Alan, thank you very, very much for talking to us and being on the program. Again, the book is called Cults. Thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Alan R. Warren, producer and lead host of the internationally syndicated radio show and podcast called House of Mystery, and author of his latest book called Cults, The Interviews, Volume 9. You can go to our website at thestuffwild.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0880, and you'll find links to Alan's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
And now, Dad Joke Theater.
What do you call a belt made of watches? A waste of time!
Join us again for another Stuff File program, Dad Joke Theater.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on the Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
I'm standing with much love for Canada. Hi, this is Erica M. I love music and supporting Canadian talent. We have world-class musicians, and it feels so good to brag that artist is Canadian. Let's protect Canadian jobs and support Canadian businesses in the arts. Shop as if your country depends on it. Keep your money in Canada for Canada.
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to an entrepreneur and internet reseller, plus Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com has an odd story for the month of June. We also have a Sir Dudley's Poetry Corner, a morning shower thought, and, of course, an idiot of the day coming your way. But we've got more Stuff File news right here, right now. Rutgers University researchers have discovered alarming genetic mutations in rodents across New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Washington, D.C.
We're cleaning up our city. We're cleaning up this great capital.
A study of nearly 300 house mice and brown rats found 5 out of 6 carried mutations in a certain gene, reducing the effectiveness of common exterminator poisons. Over 69% carried additional mutations, conferring full immunity to standard rodenticides. Lead researcher Jinjia Yu noted house mice showed the most mutations, partly because they readily eat unfamiliar foods, increasing poison exposure. Sewer rats, while currently less mutated, are catching up. The findings raise serious public health concerns as rodents transmit dangerous diseases including hantavirus, salmonella, and leptospirosis. Researchers began investigating in 2021 after pest control companies reported declining poison effectiveness. Well, maybe they should take a page out of the mosquito-chasing community. Instead of trying to kill the little rodents, perhaps they should feed them something that makes them sterile. It's not as fast, but it is effective. Thomas Tommy Dono, a 52-year-old Gambino crime family member, allegedly supervised a crew of 10 thieves who stole $1.7 million worth of merchandise from Chanel's Manhattan flagship store on July 13th back in 2024. The 3-hour operation involved entering through a stockroom ceiling hatch with some thieves disguised as construction workers. Surveillance footage showed approximately 300 luxury items being lowered down a fire escape and loaded into a waiting van. Dono, who lost his left arm in a car accident, was identified by his distinctive appearance on security cameras while supervising from a white minivan outside. The former hitman previously served 15 years for his role in the 1998 murder of FBI informant Frank Heidel. He was released in 2021 and pleaded not guilty to grand larceny charges in May, posting $300,000 bond. No merchandise has been recovered since that 2024 heist. So, a one-armed mafia hitman supervised a crew of 10 thieves who stole $1.7 million worth of merchandise. Well, clearly he had a hand in it. A 40-year-old New York woman was fined after stealing a Knicks-themed trash can during the team's championship parade on June 18th. Angie Baez emptied the orange and blue container onto the sidewalk and walked off with it, as captured on video by a JL James Evans. Baez returned the can on June 24th and was fined $175 for littering and impeding sanitation operation. James Evans said, "Although I don't condone littering or stealing, in the moment it felt like all the other crazy stuff that Knicks fans were doing." Baez previously served as an executive director at J.P. Morgan Chase, but is no longer with the firm. Well, J.P. Morgan Chase dodged that bullet. Also, may I remind you that the word fan is short for fanatic?
The Stuff File program presents asinine situations that make you want to scream into a pillow.
Those who listen regularly to the Stuff File program will be grabbing their plush nighttime headrest, not just because of what this story is about, but the amount of times over the last year that we've had similar stories. A Kentucky detective arrested two people after spotting suspicious contraband in plain sight inside a parked vehicle. Lauren County Sheriff's Office investigators observed a plastic baggie containing suspected narcotics through the car window, leading to a search that uncovered a second bag of drugs, one that was reportedly labeled, "Definitely not a bag full of drugs." 51-year-old Tracy Crowley and 48-year-old Damon Bennett were taken into custody. Crowley faces an additional charge of providing police with a false ID, while Bennett had outstanding arrest warrants at the time of his arrest. Both face drug-related charges. Meanwhile, the meaning of the phrase "lackey spooge" printed on the bag remains unexplained. Some people just habitually seem to get in their own way.
This has been the Stuff File program, asinine situations that make you want to scream into a pillow.
And now, this.
The Stuff File presents Sir Dudley Piddley Havisham Sedgwick Smythe's Poetry Corner.
My neighbour came over to say, although not in a neighbourly way, that he'd knock me around if I didn't curb the sound of the classical music I play. I told him, "Get out of my place. You're an utter uncultured disgrace. You're a simpleton loon. Don't you know a good tune?" Then he walloped me square in the face.
And let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Kira Hartley Klinger is an entrepreneur, internet reseller, and the author of Fabric Wars, and also Fabric Wars and More. Kira joins us from Ohio via Riverside.com. Hi, Kira.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for taking the time to do this program with us. I understand that when you first started reselling and when you got the Etsy page, there was a period of time between those two, actually, periods. How successful were you before Etsy, and what made you continue until you got to Etsy?
I started in resale on eBay. eBay was pretty new when I started. It was in its first decade. It started out as a hobby, and then it became something that I wondered if I could do for a full-time job when I found myself divorced at 40, and I was still raising my last child. So I was still working a side job along with buying and selling on eBay for the first 4 years. One of the things that I stumbled on buying and selling was fabric. I didn't know that there was this audience out there for vintage and out of print fabric until I bought it and tried to sell it. So I started to develop this audience for fabric, and it just kind of got a little bit too congested on my eBay page because I will buy and sell literally anything. So that's when I decided to branch off and start the Etsy store. Prior to starting my Etsy shop, I was just buying and selling on eBay. And you know, I made good money. I still make good money. Etsy, through a roundabout way, opened up all the other doors. It opened up the doors to the books and the podcasting and the guest speaking and my introduction to a TV producer of all things. That's when things really started to take off.
So what period of time did that take? Like, when did you first start Etsy?
About 8 years in. I've been doing fabric on Etsy for about 8 years now. And I was doing eBay prior to that. Well, I started on eBay in 2003, but I didn't go full time until about 17 years ago. So yeah, it was about 8 years.
So what I'm getting at is what this seems to be is a true labor of love. This is something that you love to do, and then you found out a way to make a living from it. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, that is pretty accurate. I mean, I enjoyed doing it, but it also paid the bills. And I kind of wanted to stay home. I can't say stay home. She was in school. But I wanted to be available for my daughter. I was always that mom that really didn't want to leave her kids alone. So continuing to buy and sell was a way to keep doing that while she was in high school. So it definitely paid the bills. But it also was a labor of love. I did enjoy it quite a bit.
One of the reasons I was asking the question is, what is it about this particular enterprise that is such a labor of love for you? And was this something that was always within you, like from childhood, or was this an aha moment that you came to later in life?
Yeah, absolutely not. I never in a million years thought that I would be buying and selling. I never thought that I would be dickering. The very first time I bid at an auction, I elbowed the guy next to me and said, hey, bid on that for me, because I was too shy. I was too embarrassed. And now, yeah, I go head to head. Going to the auctions is the favorite part of my job. I always wanted to write. I always wanted to be a writer. This was something that I kind of happened upon. Writing didn't pay the bills.
Besides elbowing the person next to you when you were first going to these auctions, what is the biggest thing that you now know that you were a neophyte about back when you started?
It is an industry where the more memorable you are and the more annoying you are, the more the auctioneer will pay attention to you. And the key to it is to become a favorite. That's always the goal. You want to be the one that the auctioneer remembers, either because you're a good bidder or you come to a lot of their sales. But the better you can get that auctioneer to like you for whatever reason it is, the more he's going to remember you next time, and he will grant you favors. You know, he will, if there's a war between you and the other person, he will let you have the last word a lot of times. If he thinks there's something you want to bid on and you're not paying attention, he will make sure you know he is showing it before he closes the bid. So yeah, it's super important to put yourself out there. And now when I go to an auction, I am right in front of the auctioneer and I make sure he remembers who I am.
When you're bidding on something, do you have a reseller's eye? And if so, how did you develop that? In other words, how do you know that something you're bidding on is going to be worth something else for you?
Nowadays, it is so incredibly easy to find these things out. There are a lot of people that show up to auctions that think that buying and selling is easy because we have smartphones. And nowadays, you can take a picture of something with your phone and it will tell you what it is. It will tell you how much it's worth. So it's easier now to know the value of something, but there's still something to be said for having an eye for things. And I think that I've always had an eye for things that I didn't know that I did. And it's kind of for the strange things, because you can't go to a sale and look everything up at the sale. It's just not possible. You have to think to yourself, I think that's worth money, before you even go to look it up. And I buy and sell really weird things. I don't go for the things that all the collectors go for. But you know, when I first started this, there were no smartphones. We had the internet, but it was dial-up internet. It was painstakingly long to do any kind of listings. So you had to have a knee-jerk reaction towards something when I first started. And I think that, I don't know, it just kind of stuck with me. And I do think that I have a way of picking things out that other people wouldn't look at that's worth money and that I can usually walk away with pretty cheap.
What is your weirdest money maker?
Gosh, I have so many weird money makers. One time I bought a bag of old denim, and a lot of people know that old denim is worth money. And so these were old farmers' overalls, that sort of thing. And I was buying it for the denim, but I didn't realize that in the bottom of the bag, rattling around, was a pair of old dentures. And I didn't know anything about old dentures, but when I started to do my research, there was a way to determine based on the size of the dentures if they belonged to a man or if they belonged to a woman. And these belonged to a woman. And so the era that they were from was an era where women didn't typically get the dentures. Men got that sort of thing. Women did not. Women went without if they needed such a thing. So they were worth money, and I had no idea. And I got about $150 for them. No idea. Never found them again. I find gold teeth sometimes, but everybody knows that there's value in gold, so you don't have a chance against that. But who knows that an old set of dentures is worth something? I mean, they're kind of nasty.
So that was something that you found in a bag with other stuff that you were initially bidding on. What about one of the weirdest things that you actually knowingly bid on?
Does it count something that I got to root through the leftovers that they were just giving away? I mean, there's so many strange things, and this kind of borderlines on the gross category too. I went to an auction where I placed an absentee bid, and I had to go back to pick up my items. The auctioneer said to me, you know, you're free to go look through the leftovers in the garage, the things nobody wanted, whatever. Well, also out there were garbage bags that had things from the woman's dresser that they were just planning on throwing away. They weren't even going to put it for sale. One of the things it was like the top dresser drawer. So we're talking slips, and we're talking the women's old underwear and things like that. But women's underwear, like the old silky ones that go up to the rib cage, those, the granny panties, they're worth money. I don't know why. It's odd. But I pulled out a handful of better than average used granny panties and I made like $300 on stuff that I paid nothing for. Now, since then, eBay has changed up some of the regulations. They keep changing their mind whether or not they're going to allow people to sell used undergarments. So currently, I don't know if you can do that, but I can tell you that I have seen brand new pairs of these women's underwear go for $500 a pair.
You've written two books, and I'm just wondering, did you write them because you wanted to share your story? Or did you want to write them because it would be helpful for other people, which, let's be honest, would in turn be your competition?
And that's very true. And honestly, it's a little bit of both. I don't worry too much about competition because the market's always changing. And again, I'm the person that looks for the really strange things. I'm the person that waits till the end of the auction and buys the leftover boxes and finds things in those boxes that are worth money. So there's a lot of potential out there to make money for everybody. I don't compete in the high collectible arenas. So I don't worry too much about that. I wrote the books because I started to write essays on my Etsy pages along with the listings about where the item had come from, or something funny about the competition, or something ludicrous that the auctioneer did. I just started to write anecdotes and essays, and my Etsy customers started to tell me that they wanted a full-length book, that they wanted to know the full story. So that's kind of how the books came about. My audience basically found me.
Now that you've written the books and now that you're, you know, giving away some of your expertise, do the auctioneers or your competitors now, are they on to the idea that, oh, she's making money from stuff that is just given away?
Yeah, right? Luckily, like I said, I'm in like this rural area, and I use code names for all my competition and for the auctioneers. You know, there's Krabby Patty and there's Thieving Thelma and Playboy Pete. Everybody has like a code name. But I have been confronted before. Somebody found me at an auction and asked me, hey, did you write Fabric Wars? And I was, you know, I'm an author. Well, yes, I did, you know. And she looked at me and she says, I know who everybody is in that book. And so then at that point, you just kind of want to slink away, you know, because I don't know how the auctioneers would feel about getting called out. I did have to tell one auctioneer, though, that he was in a book because the producer that had found me wanted me to tape video footage while I was at an auction. So I kind of had to ask permission so I didn't get thrown out. But yeah, I mean, there's enough auctions for everybody, to be quite honest. It has not affected me negatively yet, but I am also hoping to retire one day. I'm 58. So after that, yeah, come and get it, you know, because I want to be done at some point.
Do you actually ever throw anything away that is of your own? Or do you just sell it?
Oh, gosh. And we just went through this because my husband claims that, you know, if it's not nailed down, that I will sell it. And I just went through all of our barns and started saying, you know what? We don't use that. It's gone. During COVID, when there was a shortage of wood, I sold a stack of OSB boards that we had pulled out of this house that we're renovating, and they were all damaged and full of nail holes. And I sold this stack for $75. You know, I actually pulled it out of the burn pile when I saw what the price of OSB was at the time. I do not throw much away. If I can sell it, I will. If not, I have this Christian thrift store that is 100% nonprofit that I take my things to.
Congratulations, Kara, on all that you've done. People can go to your Etsy page and find out what exactly it is you do. And of course, there are the two books that you have written. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me. It's a fun show.
Kara Hartley Klinger, entrepreneur, internet reseller, and the author of two books entitled Fabric Wars and also Fabric Wars and More. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0880, and you'll find links to Kira's Etsy page, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order her books directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Giving you something to think about. This is Morning Shower Thoughts.
If you get out of the shower clean, then how does your towel get dirty?
Morning Shower Thoughts from the Stuff File program.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
The Stuff File program is everywhere on several stations and on several platforms, including YouTube.
The YouTube handle is youtube.com/@PeterAnthonyHolder-StuffFile.
That's kind of long-winded, isn't it? Just go to YouTube and type out my name, Peter Anthony Holder.
On YouTube, you'll find interviews, short vertical videos, and more. There's lot to check out.
Again, that's youtube.com/@PeterAnthonyHolder-StuffFile.
Oh, for the love of God, just go to YouTube and type in my name.
Coming to you from Canada, a place where fighting is frowned upon, unless it's on an ice rink. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Now, the Stuff File program presents The Weird Story of the Month with Mark Hartzman, the curator of WeirdHistorian.com.
And here we are with the weird historical story for the month of June. And Mark, they often say that two heads are better than one. And you have a story that took this saying literally.
Yeah, two heads are definitely better than one when you're a sideshow attraction. And that was the case with a man named Pascal Pignon, who was billed as a two-headed man. He was a popular performer in the early 20th century. And this particular story takes place in June 1919, when that second head became a problem. And actually, before I describe what that second head was like, just so listeners understand, this two-headed man, Pascal Pignon, wasn't what you might think. He wasn't like conjoined twins. In the late 1800s, there was another attraction. They were called the Tocci brothers, Giacomo and Giovanni, who were billed as a two-headed boy. They basically had conjoined twins. They had two heads, four arms, and two legs. This was very different. This was basically a man who had a second head that appeared to be sprouting from his forehead. Imagine about a softball size head growing from your head, complete with facial features. It had a mop of hair that kind of matched his own hair, a matching beard, and it was said to be able to see, hear, and even speak. This was, you know, again, what the sideshow promoters were saying to get their audiences excited and come see the show, of course. So in June 1919, they're touring through, he's touring with Sells Photo Circus, and they're touring through Gardner, Massachusetts, and he gets this horrible headache that's so debilitating that he has to be hospitalized. So they take him in there. The doctors then discover that this extra head, which, you know, is on top of his natural head, is not actually a second head. It was a tumorous growth that had been dressed up by the sideshow promoters to look like a second head so they could, of course, bill him as a two-headed man. And so they had to basically take this tumorous growth off of his head. They had to amputate it so that he could survive. That was, there was really nothing else they could do at that point. So they removed his head from his head and with nothing more than Novocaine to suppress all the pain. And that pretty much put an end to his sideshow career. Now, I knew of Pascal Pignon from my own sideshow researching over the years, but I didn't know the full story of how he lost his second head. And I came across a newspaper headline, which is, I think, maybe the best newspaper headline I've found. I think, as you know, I collect old newspaper headlines. They're very weird. I love it. This one reads, Two-Headed Man Loses One Head, which is really a brilliant headline because it's actually what happened. So after that, you know, that kind of put an end to his career on stage. No one wanted to go see the one-headed man or the man who used to have two heads. So he had to retire at that point. He was in his 60s by then. So at least he survived, even though his career did not. But he returned home to Mexico and went into retirement there.
What I want to know is, how did he shave the second head?
Well, I think that was all just, I imagine that was just put on there by, you know, their people within the sideshow, just, you know, gluing hair on or whatever it was that they were doing, whatever techniques they had, pieces to kind of put onto the tumor to look like it was a face, you know, kind of molding the face onto it, whatever sort of makeup they might have added to it, you know, any sort of early 1900s special effects to create this illusion. You can see a photo of him on my site, weirdhistorian.com. It's a pretty great photo. It looks, you know, looks fairly convincing.
Yeah, I'm taking a look at the photo right now. And, you know, obviously this was some sort of scam.
Yeah, you know, it was sideshow.
Exactly.
A little exaggeration.
So what I want to know is, who came up with the idea? Did he come up with the idea and say, look, I've got this tumor on the side of, or on the forehead, and I can be a two-headed man? Or did a sideshow come up with this idea and said, you know, you've got that tumor, we can do something?
It was the latter. So he was actually working as a railroad laborer, and some sideshow promoters came across him and said, hey, this guy's got potential. Look at this guy's head. And so it was their idea to dress up that tumor as a second head and, of course, promote him that way. And what's amazing is, I mean, that the size of that tumor is so big, it's freakish enough as it is. But this also reminds me of another favorite sideshow story, which I don't remember if we talked about this one or not, but there was a man around the same time, well, late 1800s, named Lalou. And Lalou had a parasitic twin. So jutting out from his chest, a little torso, arms and legs. And of course, Lalou was male, so the twin was male. But they dressed the twin up as a girl, and they promoted it as Lalou and his twin sister, his parasitic sister, which just made it even weirder, as if it wasn't weird enough that he had a body growing out of his own body. So anything that they could do to kind of push it a little bit further, they would do.
I've got a burning question here, and That is, were sideshows looking for people, or did they just come across these people?
I think there was probably a little bit of both, and sometimes people came to the sideshows looking for work. You know, they had scouts, but they would also come across people. Sometimes the people would show up at a sideshow and they'd say, hey, you know, you want a job? And other times performers would go seeking out work at a sideshow. One example was Armless Wonder Charles Tripp, who came from Canada, actually, down to P.T. Barnum's office in New York. He showed him what he could do with his feet, how he performed, you know, perfectly fine without arms. And Barnum hired him, and he was known as the Armless Wonder for many years with the sideshow. So it worked in different ways.
I have seen the picture on your website of the two-headed man, and I think there's one thing that's missing here. He could use a baseball cap.
You know, I do wonder if they had a hat on him and then took it off to reveal. Things like that were often the case. You would kind of have a nice, especially with like tattooed wonders who were actually, you know, curiosities back then. Now it's everybody. But they would sort of reveal them bit by bit to show all the tattoos. So, yeah, I wonder if they did have a large hat for him to cover up the second head and then make a big reveal out of it. A little more showmanship.
Maybe a Panama hat.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it for this week. But we do have something next week. Now, next week, we have a bonus item. And it's not something from history. It's something that you went to, an event. You want to give us a tease?
Yeah. Well, it's the Circus Historical Society Convention. So a little bit of history in there. But yeah, it was in Baraboo, Wisconsin, which was the birthplace of the Ringling Brothers Circus. So it was a really very historical site. And yeah, it was an incredible experience. Dan Meyer and I gave a talk about our book, To the Hilt, A Sword Swallower's History of Sword Swallowing, and just met all kinds of fascinating people and got to visit some pretty amazing places in Baraboo.
Well, we'll talk about that next week. And in the meantime, thank you very much, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Mark Hartzman, the curator of WeirdHistorian.com and also the publisher at CuriousPublications.com. He's the author and curator of several books. A couple of them are, and first, since we were talking about sideshows, is American Sideshow, an encyclopedia of history's most wondrous and curiously strange performers. And the second one is We Are Not Alone, the extraordinary history of UFOs and aliens invading our hopes, fears, and fantasies. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0880, and you'll find the link to Mark's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his books directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, and we're just about out of racetrack here on this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, but I've got a couple more Stuff File news stories to share with you right here, right now. Said Harry Heisman, I have dreamed of doing this since I was a young child. The dream is a particularly long one considering he is 98 years old. What this is, he wing-walked on a Boeing Stearman biplane flying over Cambridgeshire, England, at an altitude of over 1,000 meters or 3,280 feet, and was certified by Guinness World Records as the oldest ever wing-walker. I have a feeling that's not going to be broken. And what childhood dream are you still putting off? Yeah. An 84-year-old Florida man is suing Waffle House, claiming a restaurant window advertisement distracted him before a serious fall. Edward Bowles of Bartow alleges he tripped outside a Polk County location on April 17th of last year after noticing a large promotion for a limited edition strawberry shortcake waffle. His lawsuit claims the curb was unusually high, poorly maintained, and unpainted. Bowles suffered severe and permanent injuries after falling face first. His legal team argued it would be disingenuous for Waffle House to suggest that Mr. Bowles should have been watching where he was walking when it was Waffle House who distracted his attention. Bowles is seeking damages, costs, interest, and a jury trial. Waffle House has not publicly responded. And why would they have to? He tripped over a sidewalk. If the curb was unusually high, poorly maintained, and unpainted, isn't that the city's issue? It's not that he's attracted to all the pretty colors in the Waffle House window. That's just idiotic. Which brings us to the last segment of our program, folks. It's the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I'll present, the Idiot of the Day.
An explosion from a backyard shed in Lakewood, Washington, prompted neighbors to call 911. Only one man was injured, but he was in very serious condition, said Sheriff's Deputy Carly Capetto. He had told our investigators that he was mixing a compound of black powder in a blender, and as soon as he turned the blender on, it immediately caused an explosion. A bomb squad had to search through debris to find all the homemade explosive devices. There were 37, though not all were full. Said the deputy, "This is a crime. You cannot make bombs. You cannot make homemade fireworks. The man may even face federal charges." Now, why, oh why, for any reason, would you mix gunpowder in a blender? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0880. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0880. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. And you can find me on Facebook, Spoutable, Mastodon, and Blue Sky as PA Holder. Check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including kdxradio.com and over the air on stations like
World FM New Zealand,
WNRHLPFM Newport Richey, Florida,
KZCHLPFM Eureka, California,
WFNULP St. Paul, Minnesota,
CKUWFM Winnipeg,
CFMU Hamilton,
CKLU Sudbury,
Local 107.3 FM St. John,
CHSR Fredericton.
Plus, streaming on any streaming service your little heart desires. That's it. Bye-bye.
Sir Dudley here. You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I've been laying out Peter's clothes for most of his life. I'm like the human tag on Garanimals.